at 11 minutes after 8 o'clock on the Central Time Zone up here in the Lake Region of East Dakota. We're joined by Doug Greenwald, who is not in East Dakota at all, but rather in Columbia, Maryland, just on the edge of Washington, D.C. He's the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. And he's been gone for a couple of weeks. Doug, we've missed you. Where have you been?
Well, first off, let me just say it's good to be back talking with people in the state of East Dakota,
yeah.
Probably the only two deplorable people who exist in the state of East Dakota.
Yeah. She kind of blanketed the whole of East Dakota with her comment the other night.
We all took umbrage,
whatever that is. We took it. Yeah.
I think the umbrage is in the basket.
No, okay.
Yeah. umbrage. Are you using big words on me again?
Well, I don't know. Is that a big word? It's just two syllables.
Like deplorable.
You
know?
Is it Aramaic or what?
I never thought I'd look that up.
It could be. Yeah, the deplorable. There are T-shirts available. We should put some up on our website. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah.
What do you think, Jim?
The deplorables. We should write it in Latin, though, I think.
Yeah.
It should be in Latin. Would be a good idea.
What is Latin for deplorable?
E deploribus unis.
There you go.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Proud to be here.
Yep, we are. And it is good to have you back, because we really did miss you. I mean, Wednesday mornings are special when you're here, and they're a lot less special when you're not.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that. You know, for a long time in my life, I wanted to be missed by somebody, and mm-hmm. I think maybe I found two.
Aside from snipers, for example, yeah.
Well, I was up in the Northwoods of Michigan.
Yeah.
And since I have been in central Minnesota, in the lakes region of central Minnesota, I can say, you know, that's the kind of terrain and environment I was in, and you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. That we do.
So you sit on the deck of the cottage, and you're 15 foot from the waves lapping on the beach, mm-hmm. and it's 85 degrees, and there's a gentle breeze, and the puffy white clouds are in the sky.
Just a few mosquitoes, yeah.
Actually, no. Where I was, they spray every spring. Oh. I don't think I saw a mosquito.
No black flies then either, probably.
But I would go to the local village library, and for escape reading, I would just go to the mystery section and take out five or six mystery novels and do a lot of fun reading.
Mm-hmm. So this was kind of a healing time for you, a restful time. That's good.
Yeah, rest, recover, R&R, mm-hmm. yeah, for sure. And to get us ready for the fall, because this is seminar season now, and we're off and running until about the mid-November. So,
okay. You're a big John Sanford fan?
You know, I don't read that. David Da Silva is one of my favorite authors. Mm-hmm. Baldacci's another one.
Baldacci's good, yeah.
Yeah,
Patterson. Like Lee Child?
I don't read much of his books. Now, I was told to start to get into the series by, I think it's Larry McMurtry.
You know, this is everything froze up here. David, are you there? We have audio. We have nothing. We have Doug Greenwald is frozen in time there.
My attention.
Oh, there we go.
As he writes from a novel perspective about two Texas Rangers. Mm-hmm. Probably starting in about 1860 and, you know, going through their careers to about the turn of the century as they deal with the insurrections and the issues with the Cherokee Nation. And it came highly recommended to me, so I'm going to put that on the list for the next respite break next year.
Lonesome Dove guys, yeah. No, this is very good
okay,
stuff.
Okay, let's talk about some other authors. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John.
That's a familiar ring to it.
I think so. Doug, I wonder from time to time, and I know we've talked about this before, but you do a lot of research, a lot of reading, and from time to time you've told us about the Bibles that you rely on for, you know, different aspects of your studies. You go to different Bibles for different things. Can you name a couple of them just for our listeners so they might even write it down, make a note of it, and try out some of these Bibles?
Well, I thought you were going to ask me what are my favorites.
Well, yeah.
And my response was going to be, assume I have 12 children, and you ask me which is my favorite child.
Oh, I gotcha.
It's an unanswerable question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I suppose if I had 12 children, which I don't, I would say, well, I like Johnny for fishing, and I like Bethany for soccer, and you get the idea here.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what I'm trying to accomplish. So if I'm going to research, oh, let's say a passage, I first want to know what I'm dealing with from a linguistic point of view. So I may well pull out Zondervan's parallel New Testament in Greek and English so that I have the particular Greek words that are being used in the text where I think it's significant to understand it. So for example, verbs are really kind of important in many passages, and so you want to know the nature of the verb and the tense. Is it passive tense? Is it progressive, future progressive tense, present perfect tense? Is it imperative verb? Those kind of things. So
now do you know Greek?
No, I don't.
So you go back and find the word, and you can research the word on the internet, for example.
Then I go in. Well, I could suppose I do that, but I have Vine's on Greek unabridged dictionary here on my shelf, okay. So I would then go into Vine's and find out what the word meaning is.
Mm-hmm. Now, that'd be a good resource to have.
Those kind of things. Then the next thing I'll probably do is I'll go to Kenneth Wiest, his expanded translation of the New Testament. Wiest was a professor of Greek at Moody for 30 plus years. Mm-hmm. And so he wrote a New Testament that takes however many English words are required to capture what he felt was the true understanding of the Greek. Mm. So, you know, he may take a sentence to describe the flavor and character of one Greek word, you know, that's in our Bibles.
How do you spell his last name so people can look him up?
Yeah, W-U-E-S-T.
Okay, W-U-E-S-T.
Kenneth S. Wiest. Mm-hmm. Then I get curious as to what the Jewish perspective is. And so I will probably pull out the complete Jewish Bible in English and read how they're handling the text. Another interesting Bible I use is the Schoenfield New Testament. Schoenfield is an atheistic Jew who got so fed up with the way Western translators were doing their translation, and which he felt was not authentic, that he put out his own version of the New Testament as an atheistic Jew. And that's where I first discovered, for example, that he never makes reference to John the Baptist. He calls him John the Immerser.
Uh-huh. And we've talked
and the lights just went off for me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. I mean, if I could put you two guys in a time machine, and if it would ever work in East Dakota, you know, and I took you back to the first century, and I went to Ein Karim, a little village, probably about 4 miles from Bethlehem, where tradition says Elizabeth and Zechariah raised John, and we walked into the village and said, where can we find John the Baptist home? I mean, we would just get blank stares.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a phrase they use. That's not a word they use, Baptist. And, you know, after we dealt with the puzzled looks on their faces, we might say, well, I mean, we're not getting through to you here. It's the guy who puts people underwater. Oh, you mean John the Immerser. That's how he would be known. Now, let's just pause here for a moment. Why this is actually a significant piece of data. In the first century, there are five reasons you immerse somebody in that culture. Okay? One is proselyte conversion. When a Greek wanted to be a follower of Yahweh, what's called the God-fearer, then he would be immersed, proselyte immersion. Second reason would be you want to take a Nazarite vow, you'd immerse yourself. Third reason you'd immerse yourself is because you ritually messed up. You got too close to a dead animal and your shadow fell over it, called foreshadowing. And that's a breach of the purity protocol. And so you would go to the baths, the mikveh, and the mikvots, and immerse yourself to ceremonially cleanse yourself. That's the third reason. The fourth reason you would immerse yourself is you decide you want to commit yourself to a rabbi's teaching. And so to symbolize that, you would go immerse yourself in the baths. And the fifth and last reason that someone would get immersed in the first century is to consecrate yourself unto a calling or a ministry. Aha! Mm-hmm. That's what John did for Jesus. Now, why is that important? Because coming forward now, 2,000 years, when we use the word Baptist or baptism, we only have one meaning left, not five. It's new believers' baptism. And so if you stop and think about it, when we say John baptized Jesus, to our way of thinking, we never stop and think about it, but it's totally contradictory. He doesn't need new believers' baptism. He is the Word, capital W. So you see how handling words correctly really can be confusing if you put it under the microscope?
Indeed, yes.
And so I never call John the Baptist, John the Baptist, in my weekend teachings. I call him John the Immerser, you know, after I've explained it, because now it all makes much more sense.
So that's Schoenfeld.
One of my resources, Schoenfeld's Jewish Bible, got me off on that one, and that was really a worthy insight.
So that would be a very helpful piece of work then for contextual studies. I mean, that would be indispensable, I would think.
Well, it's a piece of an equation. You know, we're putting a mosaic together, and we need lots of pieces, lots of shards, if you want to use that term. So now I'm doing some of that work, and I'm going to go into another resource now called the NET Bible, the New English Translation Bible. It's available free online at bible.org. Mm-hmm. And they have about 70,000 footnotes now on this digital Bible that speak to the linguistic issues in a verse. And more and more, they're starting to put cultural stuff into their footnotes. And so that's a very, very helpful resource. And then, voila, a brand new resource. I'm actually going to share it with people at 10 o'clock this morning when I hang up on you, when my this week's newsletter goes out. Mm-hmm. Zondervan has just launched the NIV Cultural Background Study Bible. 2,600 pages, thousands and thousands of footnotes that now reference the cultural issues at work in a passage. Over 300 articles of cultural backgrounds. Let me give you an example of three of them here. There's a page and a half article in there on the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. I mean, how are we to understand that? Mm-hmm. That's a really good piece of insight. The sun stands still and the moon stops. Well, how are we to understand that? And then there's the New Testament one here, head coverings in antiquity, because Paul talks about head coverings for women. So that's the kind of material that's there. And now yet another nice resource on my shelf. Zondervan was kind enough to send me an early version of this Bible about a month ago before it was released to the public. And another very, very helpful resource. It reminds me of the old phrase, how do you eat an elephant?
One bite at a time, yeah.
You agree with that, David?
Oh, yeah. One bite at a time, small bite.
And a minute here. Yeah, and so that's what you do. You take one bite at a time out of different resources, and eventually you get a full stomach. That's kind of a weak metaphor, but I think you see where I'm going.
Yeah.
So you got to put all the pieces together. You got to get all the shards, and you got to reconstruct the vessel. You got to get all the colored chips and put the mosaic back together. You got to get all the right threads and put the tapestry back together. And that's what these resources do. So depending on what it is I'm working on, I may use from 6 to 12 of these kinds of resources to try to figure out, to try to triangulate, to use a navigation term, what exactly is going on here. And then I have the raw material now to reconstruct the passage. And once I reconstruct the passage, now the picture is bigger, deeper, wider than before. And now I can see more of the narrative story. And so now I can start to use appropriate imagination to reteach, to retell this story in ways that hopefully will have people sitting on the edge of their seats.
And then there's a key there, appropriate imagination, not making up stories, but blending in the context to come out with the best possible conclusions about what's going on in the passage.
Yeah, one of the things about context is it's a better insurance policy that you're actually headed in the right direction, mm-hmm. and it makes it easier to see what appropriate imagination might be to put the frosting on this cake of retelling the narrative, as opposed to an awful lot of wild speculation I've read and observed mm-hmm. that may be awfully creative, even interesting, but doesn't align itself with the original meaning of the passage.
How do you suppose Peterson put the message together, and what do you think of that?
Oh, you know, that's when I'm now going to quote a verse. I've done all my research, okay? But now I'm actually going to quote the verse in a public setting. I'll go into Peterson. Mm-hmm. Because typically he has a way of restating the verse and a great command of the English language, real good at alliterations and what have you. And so I'll often use his verse to read to kick off this whole thing, because he has a very engaging style and vocabulary and lexicon of words that he draws upon to craft, and I think that's really the right word, to craft a restatement of the verse or the text or the passage without losing its original meaning.
Mm-hmm. And how about the King James? Do you ever reference that for any reason other than beauty of language, maybe?
I do not. Mm-hmm. And that causes, I'm taking a guess here, 10 to 15% of the churches in America to want to have nothing to do with me.
Yeah, I know it's controversial.
If indeed you don't quote from the King James, we're not going to let you into our church. And so, no, I don't. Okay. You know, the King James goes back to 1611. Mm-hmm. A lot has been learned since that point in time. What I like about the King James, and occasionally I will cite it, because of the beauty of the flow of the language sometime, like in Revelations, the Lord God omnipotent reigneth. I mean, I mm-hmm. love that phrase. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll just toss that in my teaching as I remind people of the sovereignty of God. So there's some great phraseology that can come out of the King James.
Are there theologists?
I think some of the more recent scholarship, at least in the area of context here, is my preference.
Are there theologists we should dispense with? And I'm asking opinion here. I know I'm not looking to raise controversy here, but I mean, sometimes there's so many opinions and so many wild variations on a theme that you wonder, even if it's a 4th century theologian, you think they missed the mark. Do you have favorites? Maybe an Oswald Chambers, for example, somebody else from the 19th century. Is there a point in history when they knuckled down to business and stopped going off on tangents?
Yeah, well, you know, this will probably get me in a lot of hot water. If you want to study theology, then you want to read Luther and Calvin and Knox and those guys, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you want to understand a passage in context, that's one of the last places I go. In fact, I seldom go there. Now, why do I say that? Well, I think by definition, none of them ever walk the land. And that makes a huge difference when you're dealing with the context of the Bible. So John Calvin is often a heat-seeking missile for the theological implications of a passage, and he's really good at it, okay? But to understand the nature of a Near Eastern village in dealing with the parables, let's say, in his commentaries, you can tell he's not been exposed to it. You know, modern archaeology, it really traces itself only back to about 1865. Archaeology is brand new as a science. People didn't start traveling to Israel until maybe the mid-19th century. And then very, very few. And it is the Bible and the land. And so from a contextual perspective, not a theological perspective, okay, but from a contextual perspective, I tend to read more current sources. Mm-hmm. In fact, if I'm reviewing a commentary that I may or may not want to buy, the first thing I'm trying to discern is, has this author walked the land? Has this author, does this author get the cultural issues of the Near East village, for example? And, you know, I've got some 8 or 10 verses that I can use to quickly do a litmus test to sort of get a feel for that. And it's just a personal preference. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with other commentaries. But I just prefer people who I know, who I can tell have walked the land, have stood on the site, understand the cultural issues of a village when they write their commentary on, say, the Gospels.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much of this insight that you just provided us with is going into your work with the new Institute for Biblical Context? Because I know that's still coming together, and you're about to embark on the first year of teaching and seminars. Have you had a hand maybe in choosing the reference materials for that?
Not the reference materials, no, although we're probably going to put out the finest collection of vetted contextual resources ever done. The faculty of seven has agreed to do that, and that'll be in the appendix of the notebook that's handed out at that conference. But let me pick up a theme here, because the fact that the Institute for Biblical Context is going to have this national conference early next summer in Western Michigan speaks to some of the issues that I've been pondering for 20, 30 years here, and that in this sense. Stereo is better than monaural, and Bose surround sound is better than stereo. When I first went to Israel in 1988, I went with a very accomplished Bible and context teacher who had lived in Israel for 20 years, who had apprenticed under Dr. James Fleming, the godfather of the whole Bible and context world in Israel-based studies, and was just overwhelmed with the context that I was learning. I actually ended up working 3 years with that person almost on a daily basis and learned a ton more, and thought that I really had done a pretty good job of mastering biblical context. Then 10 years later, I went to Israel, jointly teaching with another protege of Dr. James Fleming. This was Dr. Randall Smith. And as he and I walked the same sites that I had been exposed to 20 years earlier, it's like everything I was hearing from Randy now was brand new. I'd never heard it from the previous source, okay? And it hit me like a ton of bricks. If you're going to understand the context of the Bible, you need to hear more than one voice. If you go to Israel on a 2-week study program, you need to hear more than one voice, because everybody has a different perspective. I mean, these passages are like a diamond. They have all different facets and faces. And so there are different perspectives on that same diamond that give you a different view on its beauty. And any one person can only give you one facet, one face. It's the face they see. It's the face that they've been educated on. It's the face they've been exposed to. It's the face that fits their spiritual gifts, okay? And spiritual gifts are different. So if you go to Israel with somebody who has the spiritual gift of knowledge, you'll get 1,000 facts. But if you go to Israel with someone who has the gift of wisdom, which means application and insight, now all the facts will start to have meaning. Okay? Totally different outcomes. Sometimes people go to Israel with somebody who's trained in archaeology. And guess what? They see a lot of rocks. And I've actually talked to people who've been on trips like that, and they said, oh, Doug, after 5 days, I was getting sick and tired of rocks. That's because you're getting the archaeology slant on Israel, okay? And maybe not the cultural slant. And so I have long dreamed, and I really consider it to be a dream. Wouldn't it be great if everybody who's been to Israel could go at least 3 times with 3 different teachers? So you'd have multiple voices. And at the same time, only 5% of the people in the kingdom are ever going to get to Israel. What in the world can we do for the other 95%? And so if you take these two thoughts together, how can we equip the 95% of the people in the kingdom who will never get to Israel to have 80% of the Israel experience? And how can we give them more than one voice, not just hearing one speaker, but getting several speakers, all accomplished contextualists in one place at one time with different areas of expertise and context? One might be in geography, one might be in culture, one might be in linguistics. One might be in the thematic context of the scriptures. I mean, those kind of things. Wouldn't it be something if we could get people in one place at one time to hear from six or seven different voices and have surround sound in biblical context? Well, to cut a long story short, in the last 90 days, that idea has been embraced by some other people who love context. They've agreed to all come together to do our first national conference. I'm going to call it Reading Between the Lines, Discovering the Rest of the Story. And that's because there's a whole lot of information between the lines of the passages that we read in Scripture, all the stuff the biblical authors assume their audiences know and understand. And we're going to recreate that in one place at one time. And so, yeah, it's the Lord has been doing some phenomenal thing. The Spirit has just been dropping all sorts of pieces wonderfully in place. And it may be that a dream is going to come true.
Where is this going to be, and when, and how do I get tickets?
Well, it's going to be held at the Community Reformed Church of Zeeland, Michigan, and that's just south of Grand Rapids. And it's a 1,200-seat sanctuary, a large, high-definition projection system, 14 or four video camera systems that we're going to be using. And it's going to run for 3 days, June 12, 13, and 14, 2017, next summer. And I'm working on the brochures, and we'll be probably announcing it within 4 to 6 weeks.
It'll be open to the public then?
Oh, absolutely. We're going to limit it to 500 people for this first go around. Because we're sort of limited for food service at that number. And we'll probably open up registration around year end. And a lot more details will be forthcoming. But just to give you some of the pieces of my excitement, the last author that we were looking for agreed to join us last week. Dr. Gary Berg of Wheaton College, professor of New Testament, probably the world's authority on the Gospel of John right now, has known Kenneth Bailey for 40 years. Ken Bailey was the reason he went into biblical context. Accomplished author, probably about a dozen books already. And he's one of seven faculty members who will be there. And he's as excited about it as I am, because he recognized the same thing as we started our conversations. This has never been done. This has just been dying to happen. Can't wait to be a part of it. Count me in. And if you like context at all, and particularly if you're a devotee of biblical context, you really groove on that sort of stuff, you just flat out don't want to miss this event.
And again, the reason for learning context, and you explained this time and again, I want to keep throwing this out so you can fine-tune it, is so that we learn how to read the Bible and understand it the same way as did the original hearers, the original audience, the audience for which the writings were intended, correct?
Yeah, the whole thing is, context is an approach, it's a framework, it's a methodology that gets us much, much closer to the original meaning of a passage that was always intended by the Holy Spirit. And that's where the transformational power of the passage is going to be found. So much of our anemia today in Western evangelicalism is traceable to the fact that we're not even getting close to the original meaning of these passages anymore. These passages are just like trampolines for pastors to go off on their favorite theme. One of the reasons we have what we're dealing with now is there's my opinion, too much thematic preaching going on and not enough expository preaching going verse by verse through a complete book of the Bible, which is how the scrolls were always intended to be read by the writers themselves. Here's a quote from a sermon just this past Sunday. People know I love good quotes, and so when they hear one, they write it down and they send it to me. Listen to this one. This is from a pastor here in Washington, D.C. "One of the great challenges we face when reading a story is that we know how it ends." Talking about Bible stories. Mm-hmm. "And because we know the ending, we assume the ending's inevitable. It's one of the reasons why it is so difficult for us to fully appreciate the scriptures. We're Monday morning quarterbacks. We know how every story ends. Before the crucifixion happens, we know there's going to be a resurrection. We lose the element of surprise. We lose the element of danger. We lose the element of risk. And I would add to this, we lose the drama of the narrative. We lose the surprise. We lose the tension that's inherently there in these stories. And what context allows you to do is to see the whole passage again and to appreciate the social dynamics, the spiritual and religious dynamics, the political dynamics, the village dynamics, the honor and shame dynamics, all that stuff that's just going on in these passages, and recreate it. And so we begin to discover it again as a compelling narrative, as a compelling story. And it becomes so compelling that we stop being passive observers of the passage and we become participants in the story. And that's where transformation takes place. That's where the Holy Spirit can touch us. And so this is just a fabulous thought from this pastor. His name happens to be Mark Batterson from the National Capital Church downtown here. "One of the greatest challenges we face when reading the story is we know how it ends." And so we're so familiar with it because we know how it ends, we don't pause long enough to get really into the story and to realize to the people who were watching this unfold, they didn't know how it was going to end. And that's the kind of surprise and excitement we have to recreate. And without context, you can't really do justice to that recreation.
I'm going to say it drains the wonder. It drains the excitement. It drains the surprise out of it. I'd never considered that. But having read the Bible several times, you know what's coming next.
Yeah.
And it neutralizes you in so many respects. Great thought. Thank you for that.
Well, it's not mine, but I love to collect these 5,000-foot thoughts that just say so much.
Mm-hmm.
And such a powerful rationale for why context matters.
No, it is. Exactly.
So I can leave you and I can leave your listeners this morning with this challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's just an observation. We know there's more to be discovered in the passages that we read. Come and experience it.
We're going to have to look at that. And we'll keep people informed here about about next summer's, next June's Institute for Biblical Context debut. And I think people are going to we'll post that on the website, too, so you can continue to follow the progress there. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow, Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. You can link to his website from ours at BrokenRoadRadio.com if you're listening there this morning. Preserving Bible Times off to the right there, right above Creation Moments, right below the morning show ad there. Click on that. You'll go to preservingbibletimes.org, and you'll discover a wealth of resources there. You can sign up for Doug's Reflections newsletter. He mentioned earlier he's just about to crank one out today. I'm looking forward to getting that. So do that. It's heartily recommended. And Doug, as always, we're grateful for your time. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, guys, and shalom, shalom.
Shalom, Doug.
Shalom, Doug. Thank you very much.